Are you interested in psychology and what makes us tick? In personal growth and the inner life? In the integration of mind, body, and spirit? If so, then you need to get on the couch with Dr. Dave as he interviews leading-edge thinkers from around the broad world of psychology. It's all in your mind.
Are you as wealthy as you'd like to be? What if I told you that greater wealth is easily within your grasp? Now, you're probably thinking about your bank account, perhaps your investments that you either have or you don't have, or maybe the state of the economy. But I'm not talking about money. There's another kind of wealth, psychological wealth. I'm thinking about Mother Teresa, and when she visited this country, the U.S., and of course Mother Teresa worked with the poorest of the poor in Bangladesh, yet when she came to America, she found us to be a very lonely people, which she described as a kind of leprosy. And we might think of it as a kind of poverty. So one component of psychological wealth, and a very important one, would be a rich network of relationships. Another might be resilience, the ability to bounce back after adversity. And another might be knowing your personal strengths and exercising them. And yet another might be a sense of purpose and feeling like your life fits into some larger scheme of things. These are the sorts of issues being explored by positive psychology. Positive psychologists are interested in exploring scientifically the factors that lead to human flourishing, as well as practical applications for improving our psychological well-being. Today's guest is well qualified to talk about these issues. He's Dr. Robert Biswas Diener, and he's widely known as the Indiana Jones of positive psychology because his research on happiness has taken him to such far-flung places as Greenland, India, and Kenya. Along with his father, Ed Diener, Robert is co-author of the book, Happiness, Unlocking the Mysteries of Psychological Wealth. So now let's go to the interview. Dr. Robert Biswas Diener, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm so pleased to have this opportunity to speak with you. And I'm particularly interested in the book that you wrote with your father, Ed Diener. You two wrote a book together on happiness. And in the book, you talk about unlocking psychological wealth. What do you mean by that term?
Oh, that's a good question. Psychological wealth is kind of a concept we just came up with. I mean, it's you know, like many of these concepts, it's not a hard and fast truth that you find out in the world. But we just thought that in the modern age, when people are pursuing other forms of wealth, principally financial wealth, it would be good to expand what our definition of real wealth is to include what we call psychological wealth, which would be a more consummate type of wealth. It could include having material sufficiency and goods and services available to you, but it also includes being spiritually fit, being emotionally happy, being connected to others. It's probably what the ancient Greeks would have called, you know, the good life.
Yeah, and you know, it's an accessible kind of concept, I think, that's easy to understand, psychological wealth. Because certainly money isn't the only kind of wealth that we have. And it kind of brings to mind that I've heard in Bhutan and maybe in France that there's a, what's it called, the national
happiness? Gross national happiness.
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's what I was reaching for. So it seems like people in other places are sort of reaching for a similar concept.
Well, absolutely. In fact, it's been a pretty interesting trend economically that the traditional measures of economic well-being are things like, do you live a long life? You know, does the country you live in basically provide enough nutrition, security, and so forth to make sure that you live to a ripe old age? But those kinds of measures have said very little about the quality of that life. Obviously, we don't just want longevity if it's a long and hard life, or a long and boring life, or a long and meaningless life. So So recently, I think some economists and people from the other social sciences really have taken up the banner in terms of let's add some new measures to our understanding of well-being and find out more about people's subjective experience. Not just do kids do well in school, but do they enjoy the experience of learning as they do well? Not just do people live long lives, but do they live long, meaningful lives and so forth?
Yeah, and I know that you and other scientists, particularly within psychology and within a movement called positive psychology, have gone about studying the factors that seem to underlie and lead to happiness and to satisfaction as one approaches the end of their life. What about in terms of the application and for our listeners? How does one go about unlocking their psychological wealth? Have we found out things that help move us in that direction?
That's a good question, and probably, obviously a question of burning interest to listeners, but it's also a big question. Again, looking at psychological wealth, it's a bit like having a full financial portfolio. You don't just have a bank savings account. You don't just have stocks and bonds. You don't just have a retirement account. You have all of these things, and each one by sort of diversifying helps protect you against slumps in the economy, losing your job, or any number of factors that could go wrong. And we think that the concept of psychological wealth is much the same way. I think it's fine to work on your relationships with others and connect because we're social animals and that's going to be a huge source of happiness for you. I think it's fine to have a little bit of hedonism, a little bit of enjoyment of your food, of sex and sexuality, of recreation, and that's going to help you. I think that it's good to have some material sufficiency, feel psychologically secure, not necessarily feel like at any moment you could be homeless. Exercise, flex your spiritual muscles, feel connected to a higher sense of purpose and meaning. And in this way, you can kind of diversify your overall well-being so that if you take a setback, if you take a hit where a friendship is concerned or where your stock portfolio is concerned, you'll still be able to kind of buffer against that psychological sting by having other forms of wealth available to you, if that makes sense.
It does make sense, and in fact, it sounds very commonsensical, but I gather that there's actually scientific research that supports the value of the things that you just spoke about. For example, the value of strong relationships and so on.
Well, absolutely. And if you look, for example, at a comparison between the happiest people and the least happy people, and you say, well, what separates these two groups? What sets them apart? It's not that, one group is educated and the other is not. One is wealthy and the other is not. One group is men and the other is not. What separates these two groups is that the happiest people have good, intimate, solid, trusting social relationships, and those who are in the least happy sort of group, they struggle with their relationships. They don't necessarily feel like they have people they can rely on, that they can turn to in both good times and in bad. So the social relationship aspect of happiness isn't just important, it's actually crucial. It's one of the most important factors in happiness.
Yeah, we so often are described as a social animal, and it seems like maybe that's the main thing, not the only one, but maybe that's the main factor.
Well, a lot of people certainly say that, and when I say a lot of people, I mean, people in the know with research expertise. A common phrase that's bandied about positive psychology circles is the statement, other people matter. And you just find this in so many different studies. When you donate money to charity, it repays you in happiness dividends.
Yeah.
When you donate money to a stranger, when you do any kind of pro-social spending, it benefits you. When you donate your time to charity, when you help strangers, when you spend time with those you love, when you're anticipating getting together with those you love, just all, across the board, these social relationships, whether they're fairly distal, whether they're strangers, or they're fairly proximal, whether they're close friends and family, they really reap a huge amount of meaning and sort of emotional happiness for us.
Yeah, I'm remembering a study that I read about where students or subjects in the research study were given the opportunity to either hand out $1 or $5 a day for a period of time or do something that was, quotes, pleasurable, gratifying to them, hedonistic, if you will. And as I recall, the results were that they actually got a deeper sense of satisfaction from just giving away a relatively small amount of money. It makes me think that maybe if one just randomly gave away $1 a day, it might be a better investment in their happiness than membership in a gym, let's say.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And on that study that you just mentioned, there are other studies that show other benefits besides just what we'd think of as happiness, just feeling good. When people on dodgeball teams in one study had the choice to spend money on their team members rather than on themselves, they actually won more games. And when members of a pharmaceutical sales team had the opportunity to spend money on their team members rather than themselves, they actually made more sales. So it's not just that spending money on others will necessarily boost your performance, but that it really helps you work together in a way that is improved. So there's a social benefit as well as the personal emotional benefit.
That's fascinating. I hadn't heard of either of those two studies. And speaking of money, though, positive psychology is only about 12 years old formally, and I know some of the early studies on happiness haven't been borne out, and one thing that comes to mind is the relationship between the amount of money one earns and happiness. Bring us up to date on that, if you will.
Yeah, it's interesting. Money, I'll just say money is certainly not the most important factor in happiness. You know, how good your sort of genetic predisposition is. You know, some people are just dialed in a bit happier. That's more important. Your social relationships are more important. Seeking and finding meaning at your work is more important. I mean, all these factors are more important. And yet, the issue of income, the issue of money has received the lion's share of the attention.
That's not surprising, given our preoccupation with money.
Well, in some ways, it's easier to measure. We have good measures of income. You know, economists have been measuring this, you know, in every country in the world. I mean, so it's really easy to get at these sort of external factors, and it's a little bit harder to say, you know, gosh, what's the role of resilience to happiness? You know, because both of them are abstract psychological constructs, and therefore, you know, they're measurable, but more difficult to measure than did you get a pay raise? Do you have X amount of money in savings and so forth? So to answer your question, the relationship between money and happiness exists. There is a relationship, and I think I differ from some of my colleagues on how to interpret that. So we know there's a small relationship, and then some people say, well, the relationship is small, therefore money doesn't really matter. And others say, well, the relationship exists, it's significant, and therefore it doesn't matter as much as other stuff, but it still makes a difference. So here's kind of my take home where money is concerned. Money definitely affects your happiness, especially at the group level. So take, for example, living in a rich, affluent country like Denmark or Canada or the United States of America. Being a citizen of these rich countries actually benefits you because a lot of the money, the wealth, sort of percolates out into societal goodness. That is, we tend to have relatively non-corrupt police forces. We tend to have good green spaces and public parks. We have good infrastructure. We have relatively good, you know, health care. We're pretty free of things like civil war. So at the societal level, societies really seem to benefit from being wealthy. Now, once you get down to the individual level, you're just you living in Canada or Denmark or Zimbabwe for that matter, then money matters a bit less. You could have an unhappy rich person or a happy rich person, and just the same, you could have a happy poor person or an unhappy poor person, and it's not necessarily the money that's going to make the biggest difference to whether or not they're happy or not. But money does. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, what about lottery winners? Because I know early on there was a lot of, and I've seen things on TV programs and so on showing unhappy lottery winners, people who won a ton of money and their life became a shambles. And so that's sort of the image that a lot of us have now.
Well, we certainly do have some sort of classic studies with regards to the lottery winners, principally from England, from winning sort of sports lotteries. And there are lots of highly publicized cases of these sort of mega million, you know, lottery kind of winners. And one of the problems for such, you know, lucky people, I'm putting lucky in verbal quotes here, is that what you have is a huge upset in their life circumstances. And anytime you upset someone's life circumstances where you just completely change their world, it's going to take some adaptation. It's going to be a little bit difficult. And yes, even difficult to adapt to that new mansion, the new house, and along with it, the relatives that are hitting you up for money, the you know, all these types of things, you know, the people who want to, you know, kidnap you or extort money, which happened in a couple of, you know, cases where the person was continually, his house was broken into. So lotteries aren't probably the best way of gauging the impact of money, just because it's such an unusual and kind of almost bizarre circumstance. Mm-hmm. When you look at just very wealthy people report being pretty happy. And, you know, we would all, I think, secretly kind of like to think that, you know, maybe Bill Gates is you know, kind of miserable or something, you know, just a bit of schadenfreude there or something. Yeah. But the truth is, when you have money, it allows you to pursue your goals. It gives you a sense of psychological security. It can help you, you know, live out your values. And a lot of people, even those who are very wealthy, and Bill Gates is probably a good example of this, do live out their values with their money. You know, he does, you know, obviously he's as famous now for his humanitarian work as he is for Windows. And, you know, if you think about it at a much more, you know, sort of human scale of wealth, if you had another $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, I'm not sure that would, you know, completely guarantee you some type of bliss, but certainly it would allow you to do things like help send your grandkids to college, take your family on a trip, and things that actually are not very selfish, are not just, you know, buying a sports car for yourself. It actually are very pro-social and very connecting with the people whom you love.
Okay. Now, I hear that you've been called the Indiana Jones of positive psychology. What's that about? Where does that moniker come from?
Well, let me just go on record here to say that I did not come up with that. That is not, you know, like all nicknames, you can't assign one to yourself. My colleague Chris Peterson at University of Michigan, I believe, first coined that term, and I'm both tickled by it and sometimes slightly embarrassed by it as well.
Does it mean you have a big whip and a broadband hat?
Yeah, I do not, but it has been suggested on more than one occasion that I do. But really, that sort of that reputation came about because much of the research I've done has been pretty divergent from the types of research you often find in psychology, and that is to say, most psychologists work within the university setting, and they have a research laboratory on campus, and they run largely college students, you know, the sort of the classic college sophomore,
right,
through a variety of laboratory tasks. And I think this is certainly a decent way to get to know about human psychology, but of course not the only way. And I've taken a different route that bears far more in common with anthropology. So I've gotten out of the research laboratory, away from the university, and I've had the experience extraordinary opportunity to work with groups long overlooked by psychologists. I've lived with the Amish. I've stayed with and seal hunters near the North Pole and in the very northern tip of Greenland. I've stayed with the Maasai tribal people in Kenya. I've worked with both Israeli and Palestinian sort of peace workers, just all sorts of groups, sex workers in Calcutta. Some really interesting groups that you don't typically think of when you think of your average psychological study.
Yeah, well, talk about psychological wealth. It seems to me like you've got some real psychological wealth there in your life in terms of the rich diversity of peoples that you've managed to study and to hang out with and so on. And I saw you on a YouTube video, and you mentioned that one of your strengths is storytelling, maybe your strongest strength. So I'm going to ask you to relate to us a couple of stories that of discovery as a result of your travels and living with other kinds of people. What stands out?
Sure, I'd be happy to. One of the interesting things about happiness, and I'm going to tell you a story in just a second that happened to me one time in the slums in South Calcutta in India, but one of the interesting things about happiness is people think of it in terms of the present moment. You know, you eat a bowl of chocolate ice cream and you kind of feel good now, or you gaze into the eyes of the person you love and right this second you feel this intense love, and happiness is sort of an in the moment sort of sensation. But the truth is, because we have this wonderful capacity as humans to remember the past and also anticipate the future, happiness becomes a bit more complex, and we can actually experience happiness from the past and mine it, mine past experience, you know, just like being a gold miner, and dig it up and bring it and drag it into the present and experience it right now, live, in the present, even though it's from an experience in the past. So a few years ago, I was in the slums doing work with people who live in very dire circumstances. They face constant threat of eviction. Developers are always angling for their land. The sanitary conditions are absolutely deplorable. They sometimes suffer police harassment. It's overcrowded. They have no good toilet facilities. I mean, just really, really not desirable places to live. And I was interviewing a young girl named Putal, and I was asking her, well, what are you good at? Because I sometimes ask, you know, what makes you happy? I know that it's not all bad here. Let's talk about a few of the good things that happen in the slums. So I said, what are you good at, Putal? She said, I'm really fast. You know, it's a little kid answer, you know. She's not talking about character traits or anything. She just said, I'm a fast runner. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a bit competitive, and I teased her, and I said, well, you know, do you think you're faster than me? Could you beat me in a race? And she said, oh, definitely. I definitely could. And I said, well, then let's go race. And we stood up. We put my clipboard down, stopped the interview. And of course, as we walked down this muddy footpath up to the main road, you know, word spread like wildfire through the slum area. And, you know, such a crowded area that literally there were something like 1,000 people lining the sides of the road by the time that Putal and I gained access to the motorway.
Wonderful.
And it's just like this impromptu Olympics, right?
Yeah.
And the taxi drivers actually blocked traffic. They stopped traffic with their taxis, and you know, they really kind of made a spectacle out of this. Had I known, I'm not sure I would have challenged her to the race.
I was wondering if you were starting to feel some pressure.
I definitely was feeling pressure, mostly because, you know, you don't want to beat a little kid in a race in front of everyone, right?
Whoa.
So I figured, you know, I would take the strategy where I gave it some effort, but, you know, I don't want to humiliate her.
Yeah.
So you know, we started and we pointed to a taxi very far away and said, let's race to that. And we took off running. And I will tell you that this kid, so unbelievably fast. I mean, remember how I said that my strategy was going to be I was going to kind of just go a little bit slow to fake it to make her feel good about herself?
Yes.
I was not worried about her self-esteem anymore. I was worried about myself.
Yeah, right.
I mean, unbelievably fast. This kid, I was running as hard as I could, and she could totally keep abreast with me the entire way. And then I was like, wait, she's really going to just, you know, smoke me. She's going to just race right by me. And when we got about 5 meters away from the taxi, away from the finish line, it turns out that she actually had been employing the strategy that I had just mentioned. She had been running slow to help my self-esteem.
Oh, no.
That realization was just crushing, because when we got about 5 meters away, she took off as if I were standing still, and I could just tell that so obviously that she had been holding all her strength in reserve, and she easily won the race. And when she touched her hand to that taxi cab, these 1,000 spectators, her family, her community members, the strangers, the tea hawkers on the side of the road, just erupted in unison into this enormous cheer as Poutal ran with both arms raised, like this huge victory lap with this giant smile on her face. And it was such an interesting moment to me, because here's this kid that lives in such awful circumstances, so proud, just beaming, and she ran over and hugged her parents, who were so proud of her. And I found that I was smiling, even though I was sort of the loser, right? I was the object that had been beaten. And, you know, they were celebrating my defeat. And I found that I had this, you know, ear-to-ear grin. And what's so interesting about it is I know that both for Poutal and for myself, this happened years ago. And even right now as I tell the story, I feel the same kind of sense of happiness, the novelty and the fun and the enjoyment of it. And I know that Poutal can also draw on her past experience and bring that, just, you know, drag it kicking and screaming right into the present to experience the same sense of happiness. And there's a contagious element.
I was just going to say that, because I'm feeling it too.
Exactly. That's one of the things I love about it. So this is something that happened, I think, in 2008 in Calcutta between me and a little girl. And I say it here to you today, and you feel some of that happiness. And you feel it as viscerally and as real and as emotionally present right now as if you were there that day. And I think that this is a sort of an underappreciated aspect of happiness, that we have this huge reservoir of past positive experience, all of us, that we can be tapping into and sharing and sort of raising the net tonnage of happiness in the world in that way.
That's wonderful. I am smiling even as I hear this. And I saw you've been working with someone else who I've interviewed, although the interview hasn't gone up yet, Rocco Bellick, who is a movie director who made one of my favorite films, Genghis Blues. I almost blocked on it, Genghis Blues. Ah. And he's working, and I guess his film Happy is out now. It's not out in my area. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. And I guess he's been following you around or somehow integrating some of your work into his film.
Yeah, absolutely. Roko's a dear friend of mine. He's an amazing, amazing filmmaker. And the new film, you know, he really said, you know, how can we do something new on happiness that just hasn't been done before? And how do you show it visually? And his real question, he said, you know, we understand the science. And so, sure, I can take my camera and go interview Ed Diener or Marty Seligman or any number of happiness experts. But we need to really tell the story of happiness. And to do that, you need to put a human face on it. So Rocco, I think, had the wisdom, the foresight to actually just try and go find happiness stories from everyday people. And one of the places he came with me, in fact, was to the slums of South Calcutta, where he interviewed a rickshawwala, you know, a hand rickshaw puller. You know, Calcutta is one of the only places left in the world where people still trot along with these rickshaws, pulling them by hand. You know, it's not like the hip urban bicycle rickshaws some cities
right.
have.
Right. And there's a clip of that on YouTube. Wonderful clip. Go ahead and tell that story.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, the guy, Manoj is his name. I mean, he lives, you know, like I described before, in just these absolutely terrible conditions, you know, mosquitoes everywhere, you know, monsoon rains, flooding his house, coming in through, you know, he just has this sort of ramshackle bamboo structure house. It's overcrowded. 200 people use a single hand pump to get water. I mean, just awful living conditions. And this guy was so happy. He had such modest needs and desires. He did worry a little bit for his children. He wanted them to have a better life than he did, like a parent anywhere. But beyond that, he really was able to appreciate the time he had with his children and the connection he had with them. And it seemed to not only buffer him against the dire effects of poverty, but actually to instill him with a real sort of inner peace and warmth. And I think he claimed at one point to feel very, very sort of psychologically rich despite his actual poverty.
Yes, I know that sure is what came across in that YouTube video. I really want to encourage people to see Happy when it comes to their neighborhood. I'm really looking forward to it coming to mine. Now, we mentioned that you're the Indiana Jones of positive psychology, and your dad has been called the Jedi Master of positive psychology. Does that also come from Chris Peterson?
I don't know. I think it may be indicative of too many nicknames in the field or something.
Well,
I don't know.
But. Yeah, it made me think that I need to get your guys' PR firm, and maybe I could become the James Bond of psychology podcasting.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So your dad, Ed Diener, he's one of the shining lights of positive psychology. I think he's been studying happiness for 30 years, which would actually predate the formal designation of positive psychology, right?
Definitely, and it predates it by about 2 decades.
Yeah.
I'm enormously proud of my father. I've done lots of collaboration with him. It's interesting, you know, it's not like I grew up with, you know, Robert De Niro or Brad Pitt or someone who's truly, truly famous as my father, but within psychology, mm-hmm. certainly, and he's well known. And I get the funniest set of questions. You know, one of the most common questions I get is people ask me, you know, sort of with a frown on their face, they say, "Robert, how is it growing up in the shadow of such a great man?" Uh-huh. As if, you know, my father is the most oppressive thing that's ever happened to me.
Yeah.
And truth be told, quite the opposite is what I've experienced. He's extraordinary. He is such an outside the box thinker that, you know, way back in the 1980s, he was studying de-individuation. That's crowd behavior, how you get swept up and lose yourself in a crowd, and you're more likely to lose your inhibitions and do acts of violence or vandalism. You know, something that I guess you could call fairly negative psychology. And he just said, you know, I'm going to take a chance, and I'm going to study, you know, what he called subjective well-being. I'm going to study happiness. I just want to find out when people at their best, and how culture affects it, what income has to do with it, who's happy, when, what makes people happy, what are the limits of happiness. And I think he was quite courageous academically in doing so, and it turned out to be a great success for him, but I don't think it was without risk. So I feel extraordinarily proud, and it was just great to grow up with someone who is such an intellectual powerhouse, and you know, every dinner we had was you know, just peppered with new ideas about research. It was wonderful.
Well, it's compounded, I guess, by the fact that your mother is also a psychologist and that you have twin sisters. Do I have that right? And they're also psychologists?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Well, I'm number 5 in the family, so you can imagine, you know, what we talk about when we get together.
Amazing.
Other people don't like to eat over at our house.
Yeah. Particularly if you gang up on them.
Yeah.
Now, a major thrust of your career has been the study of psychological strengths. Maybe you'd like to tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I am particularly interested in strengths. I call them the back door to happiness. For a long time, people who've had an interest in happiness have sort of asked that golden question, what can I do to be happier? And all sorts of, you know, pretty small and basic, you know, kind of interventions have come about. You can write down three things you're happy for. You can savor a meal. You know, so it's kind of basic things that will make you a bit happier. But what I was concerned about is that everyone was sort of taking this frontal approach to happiness. I want to be happier. I see happiness out there as a target. Now I want to kind of just go and get it.
Mm-hmm.
But what I realize is that we already experience happiness naturally. It's the natural byproduct of so many things that we do during the day. You know, you get a good parking spot and you're like, yes, and you feel a little bit of happiness.
Yeah, right.
Someone gives you a compliment and you feel a bit rosy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just all you're getting these little bursts of happiness throughout the day. And so it made me realize you're not saying, I wish to get a good parking spot so that I will be happy. You just want to get a good parking spot, and it ends up making you happy. So I wondered what else will end up making you happy, and it turns out that your personal strengths, these sort of inborn potentials, these capacities, these leanings you have that you know you're pretty good at, or you could be pretty good at because you have this leaning, and they're energizing by and large. So maybe you're musically gifted. You're not just born knowing how to play the piano. You must learn. You must put in effort. And I think the same is true of all strengths. You're not just born courageous and you never have to work at it. I think you have to cultivate courage. You have to fail at it sometimes. You have to kind of experience it in all of its glory. And you get better and better and better at it. Well, it turns out that when you employ your strengths, you end up feeling more energized. Sometimes you are more successful. You're more likely to persevere and feel engaged in your work or your goals. And so you end up feeling a bit happier. So in this way, strengths are the back door to happiness.
Well, positive psychology has put a lot of emphasis on strengths, at least initially. And but then I saw a whisper of something that seemed to suggest, well, we shouldn't turn our attention totally away from weaknesses. So what's that balance there in terms of the consensus that's emerging in the field or your own personal take?
Sure, absolutely. I talk a lot to people about the relationship of strengths to weaknesses. And I usually say that it's a bit like a sailboat, just to give you a pretty simple metaphor that's easy to understand. And the weaknesses are like having a crack in the sailboat or a slight leak in the sailboat. And if you don't deal with them, you know, your boat's going to sink. So you ought to deal with the leak in proportion to how big the leak is. So if it's just nothing and it's a tiny bit of water sloshing around, you may be able to ignore it. But if it's seeping in quite quickly, well, you've got to bail it out and you actually do have to attend to it and you cannot ignore it. And if it's a giant gash in the side of your boat, well, you need to do something quite remedial, take your boat out of water, put it in dry dock, really work hard on it. But the thing is, even if you sort of address these leaks and fix them and get your boat back in the water, all you've done is keep it from sinking. It doesn't help propel your boat forward at all. And that's what I think you need your strengths for. Your strengths are more like the sails on the boat. So managing the weaknesses keep you from sinking, keep you from going under, but appropriately hoisting the sails, you know, for the right wind conditions, putting up just the right amount of sheet, that's actually what propels you forward towards the successes in your life.
Okay, well, I like that metaphor. Now, I know that you're also very involved in the happiness coaching movement. What would you say to critics who might view coaching as an end run around the requirements of becoming licensed as a psychotherapist?
That's a great question. Wow. Good one. I think that they are two, professionally speaking, coaching and psychotherapy are two distinct animals. Psychotherapy is largely around addressing psychological distress, clinical levels of anxiety, depression, and other problems that truly interfere with your basic functioning. You know, they interfere with your work, they interfere with your relationships. I think responsible coaches, and I'm not going to put all coaches in this category, but certainly responsible, trained, professional coaches, they deal with people who are whole and resourceful, people who are dynamic, people who are not, and I don't mean this to sound insulting, but are not in any way broken. These are people who are high-performing individuals. And when we coach people, we're coaching high performers to reach the next level, to stretch themselves, to perform even better, much like an Olympic athlete mm-hmm. is still coached.
That's what I was just thinking, yes.
So are there times that I might work, for example, with a manager or an executive that they might bring up a little bit of self-doubt or a little bit of anxiety? Certainly. I'm not going to pretend that that doesn't happen. But the types of doubts and anxieties they bring up are not clinical in nature. They're not interfering with their basic ability to function. They're not pervasive. They're not a quality that sort of describes this person day in, day out. They're just a temporary concern of the type that any high-functioning, you know, non-psychotherapy client would have. Now with your question in mind, I would like to say, though, that I do think that responsible coaches also are aware of the line where psychotherapy occurs and are under obligation to refer those types of clients out to, you know, licensed and trained psychotherapists.
Now, I was trained as a psychotherapist, and I imagine a number of people with that kind of training might go through a thought process that runs something like this. Let's see. On the one hand, I could work with people who are really unhappy and dysfunctional. On the other hand, I could become a coach and work with people who are already happy. Which way should I go?
Yeah, interestingly, I see more and more therapists opening what we call hybrid practices. Mm-hmm. That is, because so many of the basic skills of therapy and coaching are transferable to one another. Therapists, you know, they have their normal clients. They're doing their noble work, but having a couple coaching clients might make their day a bit softer, a bit easier. And to my knowledge, there hasn't been a single study done yet on the effects of having a hybrid practice on things like burnout. But you could predict that working with a couple of very high functioning clients might help the psychotherapist to be a bit more robust and burn out less. Mm-hmm. I would love to see a study on that.
That's an interesting idea. Now, we were talking earlier about strength, and you're doing a workshop, a morning workshop, at the upcoming International Positive Psychology Association Second World Conference in Philadelphia. Tell us a bit about that association and about that conference.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So it has a lengthy name, as you
it
just
does,
said.
Yeah.
But the International Positive Psychology Association, or IPPA, as people typically call it, IPPA is sort of the I guess I would call it the world governing body of the profession of positive psychology. It's not only for professional researchers. It's for anyone with an interest in positive psychology, and this includes coaches and consultants, lay people who are just, you know, searching for their own happiness, school teachers that want to implement it, just anyone really who's interested in the ideas of optimism, happiness, strengths, resilience, or other aspects of positive psychology. So IPPA has a world congress that meets every other year in Philadelphia, and people really, it's thousands of people that literally come from dozens of nations from around the world, and it's largely talks, you know, an academic conference, so you can hear from some of the giants. You can hear from Martin Seligman, the founder of the positive psychology movement. You can hear from my father, who will be there giving a talk. But there are also workshops like the Strengths Workshop, and even Rocco is showing his movie Happy there.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm planning to be at the conference myself, and maybe that'll be where I get to see his movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's great. Well, as we wind down, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, I don't think so. I've really enjoyed my time here, and I've loved your questions.
Well, I've certainly enjoyed the conversation with you. Dr. Robert Biswas-Diener, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Robert Biswas-Diener. As usual, I really would have liked to have been able to spend more time with him. I'm sure he has lots more stories from his travels. I love the two stories that he shared with us, and I would have liked to have had time for him to share more of them. You can find a video clip about the rickshaw driver that he mentioned by going to YouTube and searching on Happy, the movie, or on Rocco Bellick, who will be my next guest, as it so happens. And Rocco Bellick is spelled, and it's not Rocco, it's Rocco Bellick, and it's spelled R-O-K-O-B-E-L-L-I-C. If I had had more time, I would have asked about his reactions to Martin Seligman's new book, Flourish, in which he demotes happiness from the main object of study in positive psychology to just one of five factors, the other four being engagement, relationships, meaning, and achievement. Since Robert and his dad, Ed, wrote a book with happiness as the title, I wondered if he felt at all undercut by this shift in emphasis. I doubt that he would have said that he did feel undercut, because I think his conception of happiness is broad enough to include all those factors anyway. I also would have liked to have had more time to explore his experiences with happiness coaching. If any of you are considering a coaching career, you might be interested to know that he has a Kindle book on Amazon.com titled Positive Psychology Coaching. That book would give you a great start in that direction. You can download the first chapter for free, and you might not know that you don't need to own a Kindle to benefit from Kindle books. You can download the Kindle app for your Mac or Windows computer, for your iPad or iPhone or Android device, and the Kindle books are cheaper than the paper formats. Now, too bad I'm not being paid by Amazon to promote Kindle, because I just did. I like the idea of psychological wealth. It reminds me to be grateful for all the non-material blessings in my life, which are considerable, and to not be overly obsessed by financial concerns, which I can easily gravitate in that direction. And the idea of psychological wealth also implies being proactive, that is, cultivating the activities and attitudes that help to build that sense of psychological plenty.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long. Just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet, and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
Well, here it is, Friday once again already. And as I mentioned last time, I'm going to be putting up weekly episodes for a while to catch up to all the interviews that I've already conducted and recorded. I just don't want to keep my guests waiting too long. I'm hoping to get one more out before I go to Philadelphia next Thursday for the International Positive Psychology Association conference that you heard me talking about with Robert Biswas-Diener. Once again, this morning my stride has been broken by having to spend a couple of hours dealing with technical support at Apple trying to figure out how to set up file sharing between my Mac, my iMac, and my MacBook Air. Seems like it should be simple. I'm planning to take the Air with me on my trip to Philadelphia, and I need to make sure I'll have everything on it that I'll need for that trip. Now, sometime soon, you should be seeing the next episode of Wise Counsel Podcast, which will be my interview with Dr. Kristen Neff on self-compassion, a research field that she's pioneered. So keep your eyes out and your ears tuned for that one. Unfortunately, I still have no new transcripts to announce. If you'd like to volunteer your services as a transcriber, do let me know. And as I've mentioned before, I'd really like to get some different sponsors going here. So if you have a business or service that you'd like me to verbally promote here, please drop me a line and let's see if we can work something out. Or if you'd like to have a banner on our website, such as those that you can see currently in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com, well, let's talk about that. You'll notice that I've not been talking about any commercial sponsors on this episode or the previous two. So please understand that it is your financial donations that I'm relying on. So a big thank you to all of you who have contributed, and to the rest of you, put those good intentions into action and add your name to the honor roll of Shrink Wrap Radio supporters, and I thank you in advance.
Hi, this is Rocco Bellick, director of the films Genghis Blues and the new film Happy, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Rocco Bellick, who I'm very excited to say will be my next guest. Now let's dip into the old email bag. First, we hear from Dan, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Love your show and am thrilled to see you so successful. You've touched the lives of many with your practice and your shows. I'm an active therapist myself and have gotten much out of this and your Wise Counsel podcasts. The attached study is a new meta-analysis of culturally adapted psychotherapy that found how to improve the results for ethnic and racial minorities getting psychotherapy, and maybe for all those who get therapy, by the psychotherapy paying attention to the patient's explanatory model, or quotes, client myth, as it's called in the study. It combines anthropology, seeing psychotherapy as a healing practice influenced by culture and culturally competent practice. Keep up the great work, Dave." And it's signed Dan. Well, Dan, thanks for sharing this article with me. It certainly supports my notion, I think, that psychotherapy has a strong element of what I'd call shamanism, although the authors don't make their point using that language. For any of you who might wish to see that article, which Dan sent me a PDF of, you can find it in the Journal of Counseling Psychology, 2011, Volume 58, Number 3, pages 279 to 289. Next, we hear from Ralph, who in part writes, "Hi, and thanks for the great interview. Your podcast interview with Dr. Stephen Porges was tremendous. I will definitely tell people about that podcast and about your site. Keep up the great work." And that's from Ralph Wilson, who is a doctor of naturopathy, or naturopathy, maybe that's how you say it. Also has a master's of science. He's an acupuncturist and a certified FlexAware teacher. Ralph, thanks for your support and for the additional email exchanges that we had. And finally, this last one is a comment by Misty that was posted regarding my conversation with Jerry Trumbull about the slippery slope of reality on Shrink Wrap Radio number 259. And Misty writes, "Thank you so much for these interviews with your good friend Jerry Trumbull. Not only were the topics fascinating, but I love hearing the memories about the discussions the two of you would have then and continue on now. In relation to Jerry's hoping that people still continue on such conversations, I have to say that those individuals seem to be hard to find, and all the more reason I'm in admiration and somewhat envy of these conversations. Such conversations are how thought revolutions begin and are reminiscent of the salons from the Enlightenment period. Thank you for sharing your intellectual journeys with us." And that's from Misty. And Misty, I thank you. And indeed, good close friendships are hard to come by, particularly as life goes on. And so it's wonderful to have this very long-lasting relationship with Jerry. And I'm glad that many of you out there seem to take delight in our conversations. Although I must admit, I heard from one person who was quite critical and did not like them. So it's not universal. Okay, well, I think that better wrap it up today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on our site. And you can leave voicemails on Skype, where my name is ShrinkPod, or on my message phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Dr. Robert Biswas-Diener for sharing his take on unlocking psychological wealth. And as you heard earlier, my guest on the next episode will be filmmaker Rocco Bellick, creator of Genghis Blues, one of my all-time favorite documentaries, and his new one, Happy, the Movie. It's a perfect follow-on to today's interview with his buddy, Dr. Robert Biswas-Diener. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.